Can a snail make life worth living?
I'm just lying there, and the snail was in its shell. I wasn't even totally sure it was alive or that there was anything in the shell. And then in the evening, it came out of its shell and started to explore. And with nothing else to do, I just started to watch it. And when you watch an animal, you sort of become part of its life. You start to bond with it.
That's Elizabeth Tova Bailey. We talked to her about her beautifully written and poignant book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. We also hear my 2007 interview with David Gessner, where he talks about his book, Soaring with Fidel. It's about his months-long observation of a somewhat swifter creature than a snail, an osprey. Finally, Carl Safino reads an excerpt from his acclaimed book, The View from Lazy Point. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Once upon a time, Elizabeth Tova Bailey was too busy and active to write, even though she really wanted to be a writer. She hiked, kayaked, danced, and created beautiful gardens for hire. Then she got sick, very sick. At the age of 34, she got infected by a rare pathogen that almost killed her. She was bedridden for a year, had several partial recoveries and total relapses. She's still not completely well today. Then one day, as she lay imprisoned in her bed, someone brought her a gift, a small snail in a pot of violets. It was the beginning of a journey of discovery for her, as she found herself closely observing the daily life of the snail and finding a welcome distraction from her terrible illness. And with all the time in the world now, she began to write about her experience. In the lovely and profound book that resulted, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, she writes, "Illness isolates. The isolated become invisible. The invisible become forgotten. But the snail kept my spirit from evaporating." Elizabeth Tova Bailey's book about her experience is, quote, "a small story about a small creature," as she calls it. But just as you can see a world in a grain of sand and a universe in a flower, you can draw profound lessons about life from watching a snail. Lessons about what we have in common with wild creatures and what makes us different. Lessons also about illness and how our connection to nature can heal us, even if that nature resides in a small terrarium. Elizabeth Tova Bailey's essays and short stories have been published in the Missouri Review, Northwest Review, and the Sycamore Review. Her work has received several Pushcart Prize nominations, and the essay on which The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating is based received a notable essay listing in Best American Essays. Elizabeth Tova Bailey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating is a story of a friendship, I guess one would say, that develops between you and a snail, and I'm assuming that the snail partook in it as well. You got very sick while on a trip to the Alps, and this is what frames the story of your book. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I just came down with sort of flu-like symptoms and some muscles that weren't working right, and just got very, very sick and managed to make it onto the plane and get back home, but had just a very severe illness that went on for many, many months. I was actually down for close to bedridden for almost 9 months, and then some very slow improvement over a couple more years, back up maybe to 80%, and then I had a whole other complete relapse, and a lot of relapse after that. And one of the very severe relapses, when I was bedridden again, a friend came to visit with a pot of violets she had dug up outdoors, and she had been out for a walk and picked up a snail and put the snail into the pot of violets. It was a snail from the forest, from the woods, mm-hmm. along the coast of Maine. And she brought it into my room, and I was, you know, exhausted from having had a visitor and wasn't sure why she had brought it in. I was even kind of a little bit grumpy about it, maybe, because she was just going to leave it there, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do with a snail in my bedroom.
Here was, you were flat on your back, and here's a pet you have to take care of.
Right, and I couldn't even get up to get a meal or take care of my dog or anything else. And she just drove off. And so I was, you know, I'm just lying there, and the snail was in its shell. I wasn't even totally sure it was alive or that there was anything in the shell. And then around in the evening, it came out of its shell and started to explore. And with nothing else to do, I just started to watch it, you know, thinking, what am I going to do with this, but also watching what it was doing. And it was very curious about what was around it because it was suddenly in a new environment. And I went to sleep thinking, well, when I wake up, it'll be gone, and I don't know where it'll be, and, you know, what's going to happen to it. But when I woke up in the morning, it had gone back up into the pot of violets and gone to sleep under one of the violet leaves for the day. Because as I was to discover, snails are nocturnal. And so it did this then every day. It would go off exploring in the evening and throughout the night and then go back and sleep in the violet pot in the morning and all day. And when you watch an animal, you sort of become part of its life. You start to bond with it. You realize that it likes all the things you like, a good place to sleep and something delicious to eat and some adventures. And that just was a very, it was very comforting to have this little creature going about its life every day right next to me 24 hours a day.
You know, I think I probably anthropomorphized a little bit up in the beginning, saying that, you know, I assume that the snail also entered into it. But you became very bonded, as you say, with the snail. Did you have any indication that it knew about you?
No, I didn't. I would think about that once in a while. I would wonder. And, well, when I say that it didn't, you know, I'm sure it didn't know that I was a human being and anything about the human life. But snails, unlike humans, they only have three senses, not five. They have taste and smell and touch. And there's no question that it probably would have smelled all kinds of new things in the room in a house, including a human. And that would have been how it would have known that I was there. And I was on one side, you know, it was living on the right side of my bed. So it definitely would have known that there was something on the other side of where it was living, but, you know, wouldn't have known what. But they are very, very aware of anything that's new or different and where a smell is coming from, where a vibration, if I rolled over in bed, it would have felt vibrations from that.
Yeah, and the snail, as you describe it in your book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, I mean, that was almost the first sound indication that you in fact had of it, or the first thing that really alerted you to it. Is that right?
Well, I had been watching it for a couple of evenings, mm-hmm. And then watching it sleep during the day, and then I woke up one morning and there were some little square holes in some envelopes and lists that I had left, you know, right at my bedside. And I couldn't think where they had come from. And then I realized that it must have been the snail, and the snail must be hungry. And so there were some flowers that had gone by in a vase, and I put a petal down by the snail one night, and the snail started to eat the petal. It clearly was really hungry, and to my astonishment, if I listened really carefully, I could actually hear it eating. And that was just, you know, I had been ill for so long and through so many relapses over so many years and so helpless when I was totally bedridden. And here I was able to feed this little animal and actually sustain it. And that was just a very wonderful feeling. I think one of the hardest things about being ill is not only can you not do the things you love or the things you need and want to do, like work, a normal job, and you can't socialize and stay connected to people, and there's very few ways in which you can ever help anybody else. I couldn't even help my dog. I couldn't take my dog for walks, but I was able to sort of caretake this little snail. And after that, I would listen at night to hear if it was eating, and, you know, periodically I would hear it eating, and that was very comforting. It was a very intimate little sound.
Mm-hmm. Now, you never do mention in the book what job you had. You make a number of references to the fact that, you had a good job that you were able to go through every day, and now you were deprived of that. What were you doing before this?
Well, in my 20s, I was a gardener, and I worked for a seed company. I also did private gardening and landscaping. And then I actually did work in book publishing. I worked, I managed some book catalogs. So I had always wanted to write, but when I was healthy, I just, I wanted to be out there in the world being physically active. So if you're sitting at a desk during the day, you come home at night and all you want to do is be outdoors. So, when I got so ill, I was sort of at a point in my life where, the only thing that is left for me to do is write. And luckily, that was something I always wanted to do. But it was very difficult. It is very difficult to write with an illness. I think anyone knows how difficult it is to write anything creative or as long as a book. It's a huge challenge. And when you add physical limits into that challenge, it's really, really difficult.
You even had trouble reading. And tell us more about this illness. I mean, does it have a name? What exactly did cause it?
Yes, I have. It's caused by a pathogen, viral bacterial. It's unclear exactly what the pathogen was, and it caused a semi paralysis of my autonomic nervous system. It actually disrupted the metabolism in the mitochondria in all my cells, and the mitochondria convert when your cell needs to take food in and convert that to energy, the mitochondria are involved in that conversion. So if they're not working, your energy ability is completely zapped, and you can be profoundly weak. And the mitochondria are densest in cells in the body that are in muscle tissue. Both the skeletal muscle tissue, which you use to move your arms and legs around, but also, even more importantly, the autonomic muscle, which includes your whole circulatory system, the blood vessels that circulate your blood, and your gastrointestinal system. So if your ability to circulate your blood is impaired, you can't be upright very easily. And if your gastrointestinal system is impaired, you can't eat very well. So the autonomic nervous system is absolutely critical to life and quality of life. It's much easier to rest your arm if the muscles get tired, but you can't ever rest your lungs or your circulation. And your muscle is a combination of skeletal and autonomic muscle. So it's very debilitating, and yet it's not very visible. You don't necessarily... you do look ill when you're so severely ill that you're bedridden, but you're not going to be moving in an unusual way. You just can't move much at all because you're so weak. So mitochondrial and autonomic dysfunction, and also a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, which came a little bit later. And chronic fatigue syndrome is very interesting right now. There's new research on a retrovirus involved in CFS. And in fact, a retrovirus can cause mutations in DNA.
Wow.
And that can cause metabolic problems, can impact the mitochondria.
Yeah, in fact, you say something toward the end of the book that evolution has been profoundly influenced by viruses and other pathogens, I suppose exactly in this sense, although this would not be a mutation, I think that would be advantageous.
Well, there are all kinds of mutations. Everybody has 10 or 12 mutations that are unique to them. We all walk around with mutations every day in our genes. We're born with about a dozen mutations. And if you get the wrong virus, it can further zap a system. A mutation that might not have been harmful in conjunction with a particular pathogen can sort of bring your system down. But it's true, there are all kinds of viruses and bacteria, but some of them are perfectly good. In fact, the mitochondria in our cells are derived millions of years ago from bacteria. And they actually think that there are some viruses that increase our ability to be social animals and might even have been a lot of what led to our Homo sapiens species as a social species. So it's utterly fascinating. You can't just say that all pathogens are bad. And I'm glad you asked this question. It's one of the things that fascinates me the most. You know, the difference between a snail and a human may end up being a different history of pathogens.
Wow.
From a very early ancestor.
And that kind of commonality is something that underscores your book, or is a kind of a thread through it. It seems something that, I don't know if it had dawned on you before, but it certainly seems to be an idea that's very present to you, Elizabeth Tova Bailey, in this wonderful, wonderful book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. Just the sense of the common beingness of you and this snail, particularly you and this snail.
Yep, I was fascinated. You know, I'm not a scientist. I was an English lit major, but I did take a lot of science in college, geology and biology, and I loved it. And I was just sort of utterly fascinated by the fact that the snail was a terrestrial animal just like me. We both had a lung. We both had a heart. We both had a gut. And yet we were extremely different. I had dry skin. It had slimy skin. I had an internal skeleton. It had an external shell. And so I just felt just so puzzled by this combination of similarities and differences. And halfway through the book, I realized I was trying to, you know, answer my own questions about why illness exists as I was writing the book. And I came across some articles on the fact that viruses and pathogens are very involved in creating new species and how a species develops through history, and that just utterly fascinated me. And I had been trying to find some kind of a link to link together these, you know, this human, the snail, and my illness, and that was exactly the piece I needed. It was because of a pathogen that I was bedridden and watching a snail, and then it turned out it was because of pathogens that the snail and I had developed into such different, but also similar in many ways, creatures.
And even as individuals, I mean, there's a sense that there you are imprisoned in your bed because you can't move. And this snail is brought in, you know, taken out of its environment, brought in on a small pot, although then you had somebody create a terrarium for the snail. You have almost seems as if you entered into the consciousness of the snail through a shared sympathy.
I think I did. I definitely think I did. I was very careful. I didn't want to anthropomorphize anything. And yet at the same time, I think that as humans, we go too far in the other direction and try to look at animals only as science projects. And they are, as I discovered, both in watching my snail and in reading incredible amounts of material about gastropods and mollusks, that they, you know, any animal that has senses is going to react to what they like better and what they don't like as much. And that's, you can call it intuition, or as a human, you can call it decision-making. But I watched the snail go through a process of reviewing where, you know, deciding where it wanted to sleep, when its sleeping situation was comfortable. It let me know when its sleeping situation was not comfortable. If you put, you know, five kinds of food in front of a snail, it's going to choose what it wants to eat because it knows what it prefers. And any animal that has those kinds of preferences and likes and dislikes, you can't help but be aware that it's making those decisions on some level, whether it's innate or intuitive or not, and just knowing that it's going through that kind of a process of reviewing what's in front of it is just sort of fascinating. Especially when you're looking at a snail. I mean, this isn't even a cat or a dog. But most of the, you know, some of the very most important work on memory has comes from research on snails. The snails have a memory. They can remember a new food for a month or two. Hmm. Who would think that a snail had a memory?
And what kind of food did the snail really like?
My snail liked portobello mushrooms.
And it actually got visibly happy when you first presented it with the portobello. Is that right?
Well, again, you know, I can say it was visibly interested. It when it smelled its first portobello mushroom that we put into the terrarium, its tentacles just began to wave in sort of slow motion. You know, I would interpret it as delight. It was clearly interested and went right over to the mushroom and began to eat. And it was so, you know, glad to see that mushroom that it slept right next to the mushroom for several days. You know, it would just wake up periodically and eat some more. Because it had, you know, at that point been quite a few weeks since it had had anything from its native habitat.
It was a whole lot better than paper.
Much better than paper. Snails have an enzyme that allows them to digest cellulose, an enzyme we don't have, so they actually can eat paper. I mean, they eat, their niche in the woods is that of a decomposer. They will not eat a healthy plant leaf, but if a plant leaf is already ill or injured, then they'll eat it. They like something that's already partially decomposed, and then they have an enzyme that allows them to eat something that has cellulose in it.
And then you found that your snail actually had some babies.
It did. I don't want to give away too much of the plot.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much, but I would say that circumstances occurred in the terrarium such that I did get into the romance and courtship of snails, and the Victorians had a lot to say about that, and snails have extraordinary love lives. There's no mammal that I or most scientists are aware of that has any kind of a love life as extraordinary as a snail.
And part of that seems to be it's just sheer tactile talent, let's say. I mean, snails, as you said before, they can smell, they can feel, they can't hear. So they are exquisitely sensitive.
That's right. I mean, you know, they're still in a world that's all sense-based, just with three senses. So those three senses become even more powerful. And, of course, they're responding to pheromones in almost everything in life. They're aware of pheromones. They can come across another snail's trail and know by the pheromones if it's a friend, you know, a snail of their species or a foe, a snail species that might be dangerous because there are a few that are cannibalistic. But those pheromones are also very important in finding a mate. So I would say that, you know, the love life of a snail is just as driven by pheromones as a human love life. And, you know, the irony is we're only discovering how important pheromones are in humans through science in the last few decades.
Yeah.
But they're probably more important than we ever realize. We think we're, as humans, that it has to do with, you know, discussions and talking and rationalization. But I think if you look at the animal world, you'll see how important pheromones are. And we are animals. Humans are just as much of an animal as any other.
Yeah, we forget that, don't we?
Yes. We also forget that we're not the most important species.
Right. In fact, our importance may be our undoing.
Yes, we may be the more detrimental of all species.
Yeah. We're talking with Elizabeth Tova Bailey about the sound of a wild snail eating. It's a memoir of a year spent closely observing a snail by her bedside while she lay bedridden during a severe illness. So this is a small story. It's a short book, a small story about a small creature, I think you call it at some point. Yet it seems to have opened into a very big space.
My writing has always been very multi-layered, and I don't sort of necessarily have those intentions when I go into writing something. It just kind of happens, and I find that I'm always looking for the bigger place I can take something. And I love taking this tiny animal, this snail, and looking at it in a number of ways, back through time, you know, to a very, very early time when there was a common ancestor between a snail and a human, into the future when I think about what will happen with evolution and different species. I actually think that snails are more likely to outlast humans. They have pretty amazing abilities to sustain through very difficult situations that humans don't have. I mean, they can actually go dormant for a couple of years, for instance. So it was interesting to take a very small animal and go both forward and backward in time, as well as to then connect this tiny animal to a human by looking at evolution and what those similarities and differences were. And then I guess in addition to that, a very important piece for me with this book is the medical humanities field, where I really wanted to get across a sense of the universal challenge of illness. And when I say universal, I'm talking about illness. Everyone's experienced a flu or a cold, so everybody has some sense of what illness does to a life, even if it's usually a very short-term situation. And I wanted to take that further, because with a longer illness, a chronic illness or injury, you're really cut off from the world you used to be part of, and that involves a lot of isolation. And I wanted to look at the idea, you know, the experience of isolation very universally. And I think every animal, not just humans, has a sense of isolation. You know, dogs prefer to be in a pack. Even snails that tend to be very solitary in some species, like this species, still have to find a mate. And within the human world, you can be in a marriage, a friendship, a family, and still feel isolation at times, because you may not always feel understood by the people around you. So whether the isolation is from illness or other circumstances, I think it's very universal. So I wanted to work with that universal experience and yet draw that into what chronic illness is like. And I'm very excited because the book is getting noticed and reviewed in the medical humanities literature, which is very important to me, and that means the book will potentially be used even in medical schools, is part of a curriculum program. It's a way for doctors in training to read about chronic illness and gain additional insights and increase their awareness of compassion, increase their compassion skills.
Oh, that's really wonderful. And how are you now? I mean, is this something, there's an implication that you substantially recovered at the end of the book, but and you must have to some degree to be able to do this book. But where are you now with this?
Well, it's been quite a roller coaster. It's been 18 years. I've had years that are somewhat better than that year, and I've had other years that were absolutely equally as bad as that year. And so it's just a roller coaster. I can't predict this week or next week or a month from now. And the book coming out was really a challenge. I mean, working on it was very, very hard. And then, in addition, dealing, being involved in the publicity from home, of course, I can't do any author tours or book readings. But the interviews I can do by telephone, and I can, you know, lie down when I'm on the telephone, so, you know, making a phone call. So I've been able to be engaged still somewhat in that way, which has been wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time and the effort to talk with us here on Writer's Voice. Elizabeth Tova Bailey, your book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, is just so beautiful and so moving. And I wish you the best of luck with recovery and you know, with good health.
Thank you very much.
The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating has received a 2011 John Burroughs Medal Award for Distinguished Natural History and a 2010 Outdoor Book Award in Natural History Literature. You can see a film by Bailey about the book by going to writersvoice.net. In it, you'll hear the sound of a wild snail eating. And you can also find a link to the essay on which the book is based, A Green World Deep in Winter, The Bedside Terrarium. Next up, you'll hear my 2007 interview with nature writer David Gessner about his book, Soaring with Fidel. Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ospreys are fascinating birds, even for those of us, like myself, who are bird ignoramuses. When I kayak out on an inlet near my mother's home on Long Island, some times of the year I can see them sitting on their big, messy nests or swooping down to the water to catch dinner. My guest, David Gessner, has an obsession with ospreys. A previous book by him, Return of the Osprey, has been called a classic of American nature writing. He's been watching ospreys for years on Cape Cod. But one September, he decided to follow some of these fisher eagles, as the translation of their Spanish name would call them, on their 7,000-mile migration route from the Cape to Cuba and beyond. The result is his memoir, Soaring with Fidel, an Osprey Odyssey. Well, David Gessner, welcome again to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Now, in your new book, Soaring with Fidel, an Osprey Odyssey, you followed the trail of migrating ospreys from Cape Cod to Cuba and then on to Venezuela. Why did you decide to embark on this wild osprey chase?
Well, it takes a little backing up to get to the chase itself. I met my wife in Colorado, and we moved back to Cape Cod in 1997. And when I spent summers on Cape Cod as a kid, I'd never seen ospreys. And I got back there, and suddenly I was seeing this eagle-sized bird, and I got hooked pretty quickly. And the result of that book was my first osprey book, Return of the Osprey. And at the end of the book, I said, somewhat pompously, I think, I will remain on Cape Cod forever. Well, at the time, my wife was pregnant, and some professors down in North Carolina read that line and liked it, and they invited me to come down and teach down here where I'm talking from. And suddenly the idea of a salary and health insurance sounded pretty good, so I said yes, and suddenly I was not going to be on Cape Cod forever. But it gave me a new way to look at the birds. I started trying to come back with my family in the summers, and I suddenly realized, hey, I'm saying these are Cape Cod birds, but they spend less than 6 months there. The rest of the year, they're on this great adventure, this odyssey, flying down the East Coast, hopscotching through the Caribbean, stopping in Cuba, and then wintering in South America. And I said, hey, I'd like to follow that, and that would kind of complete my year with the birds.
Your year of migration?
Yeah, my year of migration, which continues, as I just mentioned to you. I'm packing up my house right now and heading to Cape Cod from North Carolina tomorrow morning.
So it did seem that there was an awful lot of empathy that you had for these birds, not just fascination, which you've certainly had for a long time, but you really kind of got caught up with identifying with them.
Well, I think it's an empathy, too, for the migratory impulse, because migration's a time of great opportunity, but it's also a time of great stress. It's the time when they can, frankly, die the most easily because of taking this trip. And I certainly feel that, you know, a lot of us, a lot of human beings also are in constant movement in kind of our uprooted country. And I did feel a sense of empathy with that part of the year.
Yeah, and you followed a particular flock, actually. How many of this flock, did you ever find out how many of them actually made it back?
Yeah, well, it was pretty much in keeping with the odds. It wasn't exactly a flock. It was five different families that started out on Martha's Vineyard and went down the coast. And usually with juvenile birds, the first-year birds, the odds are about 30% that they'll actually make it to South America, where they hang out for a year and then come back and nest again in the Northeast. And that's about what it came down to. Only a couple survived the trip and got back out of the five.
And one of them was your favorite bird, Fidel, right?
Well, I renamed it Fidel. I cheated a little. Like, the scientist who I really leaned on heavily, Rob Beauregard, had satellite tagged five ospreys on Martha's Vineyard. And he was had been studying the birds for years, and his studies of kind of where they migrated were extremely, you know, helpful in opening up new ideas about the bird migration. He allowed me to kind of follow the birds, and I checked in online with them as I went. Fidel was the only bird who I got a chance to possibly see in Cuba, because Fidel continued to stay up on Martha's Vineyard much longer than the other ospreys, and tried to feed his kind of remedial young, who didn't learn how to dive for fish on his own. So because Fidel was late, he ran into me, or I almost ran into him in Cuba because I was late because I couldn't get into Cuba because of all the travel restrictions for U.S. citizens. So I had to do a little jumping around to get in there to begin with.
Yeah, and we'll go through some of that story, too. That's some of what makes up the book. But first of all, let's say the dreaded acronym BBC.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you did. when I was doing this, kind of the preparations for this book, I got a call from a friend, and he said, "Have you heard that the BBC is doing a documentary? They're going to follow ospreys." At this point, I started to kind of feel the veins in my neck tighten. "They're going to follow ospreys from Martha's Vineyard down the east coast to Cuba and then South America." And suddenly, my very original project didn't feel so original. So I, at first thought, "Oh, my God, I'm probably not even going to do this." And then I thought, you know, maybe I'll call them up or email them, and maybe we can buddy up. Because my vision of my trip was kind of a noble savage following the general route of the ospreys. And I imagined they would have, you know, vans and planes and all this. So I emailed them and got a very friendly email back from the chief scientist. And it was all kind of looking buddy-buddy, like we would bump into each other during our trips. And then suddenly I got an email from the producer that started out very friendly. And it was like, "How fascinating that you are going to do this trip as well." And it went on, and then it suddenly took its turn toward its true darker purpose. And when she said, "Our remit, however, is to be the first to follow the ospreys," and basically telling me to bug off in a very polite way. So that was the wrong thing to tell me, as I said in the book. I got very competitive all of a sudden, and it's one of the few competitive nature books you'll see. And I flew up to the Cape a week earlier than the BBC got there. And throughout the journey, I keep running into them and, you know, trying to see birds first and occasionally making fun of them in the book. Like, there's a point where they get to a place in Maryland to see a bird, and it's up in the tree, but it's midnight, and they decide they're too knackered to see the bird then. So they come back in the morning, and, of course, the bird has flown.
Too knackered?
I think it's either knackered or knockered. I can't. English listeners can figure it out. But it was to me, it sounded very fancy, and I was saying, well, that's no way to chase birds. So I kind of looked at the whole thing as kind of a duel after a while, and a fun duel. I mean, it wasn't life or death. And their show, Amazing Journeys, actually just came out, and it has some great osprey footage.
Let's get back to the ospreys. Mm-hmm. So tell us about some of them. They had different personalities.
They do. And one of the things that was revealed, and that is being revealed by research like that Dr. Beauregard is doing, is just how individual migrations are. People used to think, well, they go south to South America in the winter. But people started asking questions, like, for instance, don't some birds get to Florida and think, hey, this looks like the tropics, why don't I stop here? And as it turns out, the answer is yes, some birds do. Some birds, like the bird I described, Tasha, are great plungers in her, and they take big overwater trips and kind of impulsively charge ahead. Some birds are more cautious, and some birds even, and we never knew this before, double back. So, you know, as you spend more time watching the birds, you begin to see, yes, this is actually the personality, the type of this particular bird.
This isn't anthropomorphizing, then. I mean, you talk a little bit about anthropomorphizing, that is giving, you know, the idea that we're reading into animal behavior,
right,
human qualities,
right,
versus the scientific view that, you know, animals are just responding to basic instinct.
Right. I wouldn't call it anthropomorphizing. I'd call it giving the birds their due. And I think science, I think we're at a different place right now than we were 10 or 20 years ago. I think scientists, you know, you see it all the time in the newspapers and if you read scientific books, I think they're acknowledging that the birds are a lot more than, you know, instinct robots and that other animals are. I think anyone who's owned a dog knows this. And it's not, I mean, there are two poles. There's kind of the Disney cute anthropomorphized animal. But then there's that other pole, which is just as much a caricature, which is animal instinct, do this only. You know, we know at this point that it's the mucky middle, it's somewhere in there where you get a more of a sense of what the animal's actually like. Alan Poole, who was kind of my Obi-Wan Kenobi in the first Osprey book, you know, he was a great scientist and biologist, and is a great scientist and biologist, and he would take notes watching the birds at the nest, and he'd watch them for hours and hours, and often the notes amounted to nothing more than bird returns with fish, bird feeds fish to female, female feeds fish to young, you know. But taken together, this observation builds up into something that it might not be too hokey to call it kind of loving in the sense of empathy. By, you know, by scientifically gathering these facts, we can really begin to understand better what the bird's world is like.
Well, isn't the idea also that they just respond to basic instinct, kind of making that very anthropocentric idea that we're different from everybody else, and that there's not a sense of in which we're part of the animal kingdom?
Exactly. And that's one of the big parts of the book, is just how animal and physical human beings are. I said in the book that people who think that our animalness contradicts miracle, the sense of miraculousness, are wrong-headed to me, because evolution is the miracle. This is a miraculous thing that we're these animals that we are. And there's a big sense, I think, that I try to get across in the book of the Montaigne quote, when we, as high as we rise in the world, on the highest throne, we're still sitting on our own butts. You know, it's just that it's when we try to rise too high, when we try to make these, you know, standards that are superhuman, that we become subhuman and we become lesser. So it's kind of an acceptance of our animal selves that really kind of liberates, I think, and allows us to get a sense of where we are in the world and how we're united with other animals in the world.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. You're hearing a 2007 interview I did with nature writer David Gessner about his book, Soaring with Fidel. It's about an osprey he followed, or tried to follow, on his migration from Gessner's native Cape Cod to Cuba and further south. Now, do ospreys find their roots by instinct, or is it learned? How is this mixed with them?
It's a combination, because the first year certainly is an instinct. It's an impulse to fly south, because one thing, both of the parents usually take off before the young birds head south. Now, the young birds are only like 5 months old, 4 months old, and they will then, once they feel, you know, they've got their wings, they will kind of head south, prodded by instinct, prodded by things we really don't understand. We don't know yet, you know, and guided by things we don't understand. You know, we have an internal compass, and we don't know how much sunlight and has to do with it, how much all different things have to do with what's kind of pushing them to go. And then they go south, and say they get blown off course. Say they're heading, and it looks like they're going down to Colombia, and they get blown off to the east, to Venezuela. Well, they imprint that place where they end up, just like they imprint their home place, say, back on Cape Cod or the Northeast, and then they spend the rest of their life, and it can be a pretty long life, up to 30 years sometime, going back and forth between these two home places.
And that's a pretty long journey, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of them, you know, it totals out around 7,000-mile round trip.
Wow. Now, you decided to go to Cuba, and as you said before, it was a real challenge to get there. How did you get there, and why was it so much more difficult? I have to say that I went to Cuba also a long time ago, 1970 and 1971. It was also difficult to get there. We had to go through a third country, as you do now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that things eased up for a while, and Clinton actually started to tighten things up, and Bush has really tighten the clamps quite a bit. In fact, continues to tighten. And of course, one of the reasons for this is the Florida vote, which, in, you know, back in Gore Bush, we found out how important that Florida vote was. And there's a very strong anti-Castro Cuban population there who do not want to have the blockade or the embargo lifted. So it's continued, even though it's kind of a unique situation. It's a country we're not at war with. All the other old communist countries we've kind of, you know, we now have trade with, and we just, it's kind of this historical remnant, and we continue to stop. We allow our citizens to travel there as long as they don't spend any money. And this has led to very elaborate, like Canadian travel agencies that you pay, and then they set up your ticket and your hotel reservations. Anyway, I thought I had a very good case going in that I was going there for my job as a working journalist, because I was writing a book, and as a professor teaching and doing research on the birds. So I thought I had a good case, and I was trying to do the research. But in the course of my time, what had been the general permit, which meant you could qualify kind of under a general umbrella, turned into a specific permit. And I didn't have time to turn around and get the specific permit quickly enough. So I decided to take my chances, feeling that my case was a strong one. And I flew down to Cancun and into Cuba. And as you know from reading the book, I got into trouble both ways. On the way out, I was pretty much on the way to the airport when I got a call from Cuban immigration, and I sweated through a good half an hour in a seat while they questioned me. And in the middle of the questioning, I tried to explain in my horrible Spanish, me gusta mucho la águila pescadora. I like the ospreys. I love the ospreys. And then one guy who I hadn't thought could speak English suddenly said, "You are allowed to come to our country for tourism. You are not allowed to come for work." You know, and I froze at that. And then he went into another room, and the other two went into another room. And then they came out, 20 minutes later, after I was sweating through my shirt, they came out and said, "We are holding your plane. You've got to catch your plane." And they sent me off. And then when I came back through, of course, I admitted that I'd been to Cuba, which a lot of people don't. A lot of people Cuba doesn't stamp your passport, so people kind of come skipping back in with that lie. And I admitted it, knowing that I was going to write a book about it and feeling pretty confident in what I'd done. And then the government got in touch with me, and I got a pro bono lawyer who put together kind of our case, and the case is still pending. One of the obvious ironies is that there's this sheer freedom to migration. And migration, a very important part of it is it links together all these disparate places. It linked to me my home in Cape Cod, to Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania, Cape May in New Jersey, and then to the Cuban mountains, and then to Venezuela. So there's this freedom and linking of migration. And then, of course, it links the U.S. and Cuba. But the obvious irony here is our country, waving the word freedom around, restricts its own citizens from traveling to a country it is not at war with.
Right, exactly. Now, you met a pretty remarkable guy in Cuba.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I would have even gone on the trip had I not known about Freddy Rodriguez Santana. But, he really exceeded my expectations, and he really took me, no pun intended, under his wing and showed me the osprey migration coming through Cuba. Freddie had been always into animals and had read Jack London and Hemingway as a kid. And then he decided to go into training dolphins, but he soon learned that the dolphins did not like captivity at all and kind of became disturbed. So Freddie found an osprey with a tag on it, and the tag led him to Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania, and a great ornithologist teacher named Keith Bildstein. Keith brought Freddie up to become the first Cuban intern at Hawk Mountain. Very exciting for Freddie to travel out of Cuba and learn at the feet of one of our great bird heroes. And then Freddie took that knowledge and went back to Cuba, and he started to study the osprey migration coming through Cuba. One of the reasons it's so exciting is most birds are hydrophobic. They're afraid of the water, and they end up migrating down through Mexico, and most other raptors do that too. But ospreys don't fear the water, so they head right down. And by the time they start flying down the spine of Cuba, and by the time they get to the east end in the mountains where Freddie lived, you can see literally flocks of ospreys, which you see nowhere else. And on one very spectacular day, Freddie kind of confirmed all these theories he'd been working on. He saw 603 ospreys flying overhead. And, one of the reasons I dwelled on that moment in the book is, for me, it put together so many things. It was, for Freddie, it was a moment of great scientific discovery. I said it was like it would be as if Edison saw light bulbs flying overhead. It was this, it was this confirmation of years of theory saying that the ospreys came through this point. And he also had his son, Fredito, in his arms when he saw it. So there was this kind of link, again, back to that animal aspect. And there's also, just on a simple level, the sight of seeing those birds coming overhead is one of the most physically thrilling sights I've ever seen. So I think that, you know, I call it Freddie's Finest Hour, which is a little bit of a play, not just on Churchill, but on the Teddy Roosevelt myth, which had been created only about 10 miles from there on San Juan Hill. You know, for me, it was very exciting that all these myths, these high points in people's lives, occurred at literal high points. You know, Freddie up on La Grande Piedra, that's the big rock, which is the third largest rocks in the world, on top of a mountain, had his big day. You know, Castro also hit out in the same mountains as Sierra Maestra, you know, and that's where his myth was kind of created. And also Teddy Roosevelt's charge to the top of the hill was another example of being on a high point.
Well, the book is Soaring with Fidel, An Osprey Odyssey. Thanks so much, David Gessner, for coming onto Writer's Voice again.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to talk with you, Francesca.
Nature writer David Gessner. In addition to Soaring with Fidel, he's the author of 7 other books, including The Prophet of Dry Hill, Return of the Osprey, and The Tarball Chronicles. He's coming out with a new book, My Green Manifesto, Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism. In keeping with our nature theme today, let's hear a clip from a forthcoming interview with marine ecologist and nature writer Carl Safina about his acclaimed book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. In this excerpt, Safina talks about writing about nature and reads a passage from The Prelude. This book, The View from Lazy Point, not only talks about all the things that we've been discussing here, but is also written with great beauty and poetry. I think you do it very, very successfully. A lot of nature writers do write with a lot of poetry in their writing, but yours is the turn of the phrase is just marvelous. I'd like to ask you, would you be willing to read from your prelude?
Oh, sure.
Of the book? That would be great.
I'm really gratified that you're talking about the writing itself, because one thing I've always been is a synthesist, and there are plenty of people who write about nature, and there are plenty of people who write about environmental issues, and not a lot of people put those things together in a way that makes it very enjoyable to read. So that's the task that I set out for myself. Okay, so the very, very beginning of the book, what you would think of as the preface, is called the prelude in this book, and here's some of it. I slide a fishing rod into my kayak as birds begin gathering over our bay. They know what's coming, and so do I. On many summer afternoons, packs of surfacing bluefish chase up small fish, drawing excited flocks of diving terns. As it has been for millennia, so it is this very moment. Contrary to all the gloom in the news, the future is by no means doomed. I'm continually struck by how much beauty and vitality the world still holds. But beauty and vitality isn't the whole story either. In the panic among the fishes and in the frenzying terns, it's also evident that nature has neither sentiment nor mercy. What it does have is life, truth, and logic, and it strives for what it cannot have. An end to danger, an assurance of longevity, a moment's peace, and a comfortable death. It's like us all, because we are natural. What anyone needs to know about mercy, one can learn from watching nature strive, seeing people struggle, and realizing what a compassionate mind could add to the picture. So I'm also struck that we who have named ourselves wise humans, Homo sapiens, haven't quite realized that nature, civilization, peace, and human dignity are all facets of the same gemstone, and that abrasion of one tarnishes the whole. It's true that a lot was gone before I got here, but there's quite a lot left, you'll see, as watching those terns and fish and the activities of my human neighbors continually reminds me, the world still brims with the living. Yet here's the paradox. In the cycle of seasons and the waves of migrating fishes and birds that come and go along my home coast, I still find sanity, solace, and delight, more than a few fresh meals, and the power and resilience of living things. The wider lens of distant horizons, however, reveals people and nature up against trends serious enough to rattle civilization in this century. The world still sings, yet warnings are wise. We're risking much. We're borrowing heavily from people not yet born. Meanwhile, the framework with which we run our lives in our world, our philosophy, ethics, religion, and economics, can't seem to detect the risks we're running. But how could they? They're ancient and medieval institutions, out of sync with what we've learned in the last century about how the world really works. So, how to proceed? I've come to see that the geometry of human progress is an expanding circle of compassion, and I believe that, if the word sacred means anything at all, the world exists as the one truly sacred place.
Carl Safina, reading from his book, The View from Lazy Point. We still have a few minutes left. We end with the great poet, Richard Wilbur, talking about and reading his poem, A Barred Owl. I visited him at his home in 2009.
I have a little poem called A Barred Owl in which I say that that one thing poetry does is to teach us to say the names of what we dread, what we fear. Any kind of articulateness is emboldening to the human creature. And that's one job that poetry does, I think. As Thomas Hardy said, to have a look at the worst, to specify what is dreadful, is in some degree to disarm those things.
Do you have that poem at hand? Could you read that to us?
Yes. This is the poem we were speaking of. It's called A Barred Owl. And when I read this to an audience, I always remind them that a good many of them will already understand that what the barred owl says when it cries out in the woods at night is, "Who cooks for you?" A barred owl. The warping night air having brought the boom of an owl's voice into her darkened room. We tell the wakened child that all she heard was an odd question from a forest bird, asking of us, if rightly listened to, "Who cooks for you?" And then, "Who cooks for you?" Words which can make our terrors bravely clear can also thus domesticate a fear and send a small child back to sleep at night, not listening for the sound of stealthy flight or dreaming of some small thing in a claw borne up to some dark branch and eaten raw. There was a teacher in the Philadelphia area who told me that one of her students had said, "Oh, A Barred Owl, that's that poem which begins like a lullaby and ends like a nightmare." and it does. But I think, as I said, that one of the functions of poetry is to make our terrors clear and so disarm them a little. The worst thing of all is nameless dread, isn't it?
Richard Wilbur reading and talking about his poem, A Barred Owl. You can hear the whole wonderful interview he gave me by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.